keep going.
Hello. Welcome back to the Keep Going podcast. Or welcome to the Keep Going podcast. Now, I know in the last episode or two, I have mentioned that I was not really going to do any more intros to these episodes. But here I am doing another intro. And there's a really good reason for it. Because in this episode, we're going to introduce a series in which we endeavor to educate and potentially inspire my co-host Michael to becoming a track and field fan. We're rapidly approaching the 2024 Paris Olympics, and I think our sport is seeing an incredible resurgence and revolutionary excitement that we've never seen before. And so I'm hoping to get him on board with being a track fan. So as the series unfolds, we'll go through each of the middle distance events and unpack each event, some of its history, and really attempt to set the stage for what's going to transpire this spring and summer. I think this will be an effective way, or hopefully an effective way, to get people to recognize the historical context, but also really just jump into the action. We're going to go through the 10,000, then the 5,000, the steeplechase, the 1,500, and the 800. We may not do that in consecutive episodes. It just depends on where we're going with things and how we're feeling about things. But ultimately, that's our plan, is to go through each one. So it is absolutely an incredible time to be a track and field fan. Each event now has an unprecedented amount of drama, really compelling storylines and rivalries, and we're seeing an absolute renaissance in the sport. And especially in the middle and the long distances, as the Americans are finally becoming competitive and the hegemony of the East and North Africans is beginning to be broken up. So it's a very exciting time, at least in my opinion, to be a fan. And we hope you'll consider joining us on this journey we call How to Become a Track Fan, an introduction. Godspeed, my friends. Godspeed.
What's going on now? This is a big one.
What?
I'm real excited about this.
This topic?
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. This morning, I go on walks on some Thursdays with my good friend Tomek, who I heard has been running with the Atreyu Run Club a little bit more.
He's popped into the Wednesday group.
That's good. He's good vibes. He's a good vibes dude. I was talking to him on our hike today about this podcast, and he said he was very interested to see which directions we go with it. Because, you know, he and I had a podcast we did for a while called Fanboys.
Yeah, I remember you. I never met Tomek at that point.
Yeah, so. It was a pretty deep, it's kind of like what I did on the Running Rogue podcast with Chris McClung. We would spend 15 minutes in each episode talking about what happened in running, what happened globally in the running culture world, like running competition world, and then we would go into whatever topic we had. Yeah. But Tomek and I's episode was like a biweekly or a monthly episode around, mm-hmm. like for an hour, talking about all the things that happened. And as
I'm sure he can meet you in the middle on that one.
Oh, he does. He goes toe to toe. Yeah, uh-huh. He goes toe to toe. In fact, in some ways, he's more of a fan than I am. I'm jaded. There's a level of have been at it for a very long time that I don't go as deep into all of the races that are available on any given week. I just sort of continue to scratch the surface. What I'm looking for in my track fandom are the stories, are the narratives that follow the arcs of either a hero's journey or the arc of a fool's journey. And you know, I lean towards the fool's journey, but I value the hero's journey for its cultural relevance. And so this is the place where my entertainment And this is one thing I wanted to start this episode on with, so I'm glad we're here. Mm-hmm. Just so everyone understands, in my personal view, I'm not saying this not to offend anyone, not to upset anyone, but you need to understand where I'm coming from. Track and field is entertainment. In my opinion, modern sports are entertainment. Yes, there is a component of people making a living at it, but just like Michael Jackson made a living at putting out incredibly well-crafted pop songs, these athletes are just doing the same thing. It's high-end artistry, but it's not like something other than entertainment. So that's my personal view. So sometimes when you hear me get vehement or excited or really opinionated about a topic, it's just the same way I would about a particular genre of music or an mm-hmm. artist. And so there's a lot of pull through for the few little episodes we did around music with John, you and John and I, and then the one that we did separately ourselves. It's, to me, this is what I think track and field or distance running storylines are. They're narratives that help us, like, entertain us about what it's like to be human. So
that's an interesting perspective, because I have traditionally not been, I'm not saying that track and field isn't entertaining. So everything that comes after this doesn't mean that I don't think it's entertaining. It just means that I usually pass up the channel and without thinking about it. Like, it's not a salient idea to me where I'm like, what's going on in track and field right now? It's easier for me to focus on, for whatever reason, the marathon specifically, because like I participate in, you know, I like, even when you delineate between the half and the full and a 10K and a 5K, like, I don't even really participate too much in the 10K and the 5K just because I probably should, and they're a lot of fun, but I'm just more attracted to the half and the full. So anyway, I kind of pass that bandwidth up sometimes, and that's why I think this is going to be a fun conversation, because deep down inside, like, I'll go to like letsrun.com every once in a while and be like, what am I missing? How do I tap into this? Like, why is there a frenzy out there? I get why there is. Like, why am I into watching YouTube videos on how to model 3D, you know, objects and Rhino? Like, religiously. What? Like, why could I talk about that for 5 hours? And I'm thinking, it's so close to home. Track and field is so close to home to me, but what am I missing? The Olympics are coming up. It's in like, is it July? Mm-hmm. Like late July mm-hmm. into early August. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what am I missing so that I can get super stoked about the Olympics? Like, I want to go into it this year thinking like a track and field enthusiast, and I want to be able to watch it of all its entertaining glory. And for the first time, I feel like I'm ready for this, you know? And my background is that track and field in my hometown, you know, wasn't necessarily the thing. It was what football players did in the off season.
Spring football.
Yeah. It was spring football training. And there was just me, because my mom was like, you got to do something. You got to play a sport. And I was like playing hockey and shit. But like, you know, when it came to school, it was like, all right, I'll do cross country. And that was kind of like even adjacent to track and field. It was just so kind of like esoteric to me, like what it even was, what purpose it served. We didn't have a community of people. Like, there were one or two people out there really, really into it, ready to go. You know, one or two groups out there, like, ready to go. But a lot of it was just kind of like, it was almost utility, and it was just cultural. And it was maybe in my area, like, I don't know, maybe it was just me, because I was like smoking cigarettes and shit, and like, I wasn't really into it. But my theory is that track and field is so close to home to me. I literally design and produce running shoes. Like, why am I missing the bandwidth of the entertainment station of track and field? And can you sprinkle some fairy dust on there going into the Olympics? Because that is my goal. Like, I'd like to convert myself into a true fan.
Awesome. What a great setup. And so these series, we're not sure how many it'll be.
Yeah.
It'll be at least two or three, maybe more, depending on how we break it up.
Mm-hmm.
We're just going to periodically check back in and talk about, can we make Michael a fan?
Yeah, it's a great idea.
And Austin, my main objective here, just to be clear, to make sure everyone's clear on this, is to really introduce him to the 800, the 1500, the 5K, the steeplechase, and the 10K, because that's the most relevant for the marathoner, half marathoner, triathlete kind of perspective. That doesn't mean we won't talk about the full three ring circus, and I'll go in a little bit more about the three ring circus. And I really do hope eventually.
Is it the sum of the parts? Is it the, you know, that's what I'm into, is kind of like, what's the vibe?
And we're going to talk about that today a little bit, but we're not going to though go in and then talk about the 100 and the 200, and we're not going to talk about the high jump and the pole vault, although I love all those events. We're really going to focus on the middle distance and distance running events because they're salient to our audience primarily, and they're salient to you in terms of you as a potential person that's like our audience, right?
Yeah.
But don't make that seem that we're privileging the middle distances and the distances from a storyline or narrative perspective. I think of track and field as a package, as Mike, as you said, a full package, and it's best to be sold that way. But we have these various different genres, or they're basically what we call event groups. And the four basic event groups in track and field are the sprints, the field events, and the distances. Now they get broken up into further by going
sprinting is a little bit different than
sprints are sprints and hurdles. Okay. Yep. Sprints and hurdles. Yeah. And that goes up to the 400. So in those events you have the 100. In outdoors, you have the 100, the 200, the 400, and then you have the 400 hurdles. But you also have the 110-meter hurdles, which are high hurdles. Yeah. Which, if you want to get a real feel for the difficulty of track and field, stand next to the high hurdles. They would come up to almost your neck. They come up to the mid chest. They're high. Like, these are big. The men's are high. The women's are higher, but they're not quite as high as the men's are. And then when they do the 400 hurdles, they're a different level. So they're different height. So that's the sprints. Now, if you do
the sprints, is that usually packaged up? We'll get into this, but just right off the bat, when you're a sprinter, are you considered a sprinter 400 and below?
Typically, there is a very rare bird that are the 4.8, and they mostly were that way in high school, and then they had to kind of choose. But many of them end up being 4.8 people, end up going down to the 4, or they'll choose maybe to move to the 400-meter hurdles, especially if they can get the hurdles down. The hurdles are, the 400-meter hurdles are one of the hardest events.
If you're a sprinter, are you expected to be a hurdler?
No, the hurdlers are they're a type.
It's a whole different group.
It's very much, almost very, only occasionally do you see someone split.
Okay.
100 to hurdles. Very rare.
And so it's not called short distance. It's usually called sprinting, and then you jump up to middle distance.
And we go middle distance, and middle distance is the 800 and the 1500.
Mm-hmm.
And then the long distances are the steeplechase, the 5K, and the 10K. Now, some people put the steeplechase down into the middle distance category. I never have. The steeplechase is a very unique thing. I did it all through college, so I have a lot of understanding around it. So those are the distance races. Then you have the field events, and this is where there's usually a big separation. Like, you usually have the jumps and the throws. So you have the jumps, which is the high jump, the long jump, the triple jump.
Mm-hmm.
This is really relevant. The high jump right now is about to do a radical change. They're looking like they're going to pull the trigger on it, a huge change to the long jump in terms of the way it's done.
The long jump?
They're talking about getting rid of the board on the long jump.
Mm-hmm. And the red board.
Where you have to, if you step over it, you get a disqualification. And they're talking about getting rid of it because they think they want to see the athleticism. But the problem is, I think that's a big mistake, but that's another topic.
It takes away some of the artistry and the finesse and the history behind
Correct. So, yeah. And then those throws are another jump.
Javelin. And
the throw of the javelin, the shot put, the discus.
Yeah.
Now, there's another event called the pole vault, which really I think they throw it in the jump category because you jump off the pole, but it's kind of in its weird space. And it is one of the most badass and coolest events.
Yeah,
for sure. The men's and women's pole vault are, to me, it may be my second favorite events in the sport, but all of them. And the cool thing about track and field is, think about somatotypes, how human bodies are.
Yeah, they're all represent kind
they're
of
all
different
represent,
facet.
Almost all represented.
So that's interesting.
The ectomorph, the mesomorph, mm-hmm. the endomorph, they're all kind of represented. You got the tiny little people. You've got the really muscular, strong people. You've got the huge throwers, and then you've got the pole vaulter. And we like to talk about it in the form. I like to converse about this. The sport is greatest when it's considered a three-ring circus. Just like Barnum and Bailey's, what would it go on is that you would have the fire throwers, then the tiger show would come out, and then the acrobats would come out, and then the monkeys would come out, and then the other thing would come out, and they would just constantly be this play where you would get the drama of the different events played into the sport. One of the reasons, I'm going to go back to one of the things, like, why haven't you caught this bug? In my opinion, the reason you haven't caught the bug, because it's important, cross country is the most participated sport in the United States.
But they separate it from track and field.
It is, and that's another story altogether, but I just want to state that. And then if you combine spring football, I think track and field and cross country are two of the most competed in sports by Americans in the world. I mean, by Americans. So if you think, I mean, the percentage is pretty large. I mean, you think football or soccer or baseball, you'd think, it's track and cross country.
Really?
Is the most participated
cross
sport.
Cross country doesn't surprise me. It kind of does because it's always such an underfunded program in the high schools and mm-hmm. things like that, and it's really ragtag.
Super cheap, and it's cheap. It's super inexpensive.
Yeah,
you don't have to have gear.
A lot of the times, I would imagine. It is a different cross country. It's a different season.
It's in the fall,
yeah,
typically, and it's used as its own sport. But it has always been used. It has been used as much as another sport's cross training. As well, so basketball. You see this a lot. Where
yeah, they're always running
basketball.
Coach maybe run cross country.
Exactly, because the fundamentals of fitness are aerobic. The aerobic capacity and aerobic strength is really important in every sport. But that's where it a lot of times gets
track
a bad rap.
Track and field starts in the spring.
It starts in the spring and it runs through the summer. In high school, it's spring. Usually in Texas, it starts in March. In other events, now there's another whole genre of the sport called indoor track. We just had our indoor world championships, which has sparked this conversation because I was like, did you watch indoor?
He goes,
I don't even know what indoor is.
Why is everybody saying one is better than the other, indoor versus outdoor? And that to me, that's another layer of the equation.
Correct. There's a limited number of events in indoor track, and it was created basically, well, it's always been going on. Even, you know, back in the 1800s, there were indoor track races, but they were...
I'm assuming it's a 200?
It's a two... Well, it depends on the field house, depends on the size. They have tracks for indoor track are shorter.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there's a ongoing recent discussion about changing it from indoor track to short track, but that's another thing altogether, but it doesn't really matter. But it's a shorter track, and it's in the reason why it's indoor because it's in an indoor facility and it's early in the winter. So it's like it starts in December, but usually really starts
and finishes. Cross country is wrapping up, then they want to relay that into
the indoor track, which is that has a shorter
running,
and they have a 60 meter hurdle and a 60 meter dash. So instead of the 100 and 200, they only have one. Although they do have the 200 in it. They have the 60 meter dash, not the 100. Then they do the 200 and the 400. There are no hurdles indoors. No hurdles at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a limited number of field events. They don't have all the field events. They don't show throw the javelin. They don't throw
because
the
disc.
They just limit it. But they do have all of the horizontal jumps and all the vertical jumps.
Indoor gets a little bit of flack.
It's not as well known. It's not as well represented, especially in the southern states and mm-hmm. in California, because we don't really, it's expensive to build those field houses. It's expensive to build those tracks. But in the Northeast, because the kids need something to do during,
mm-hmm.
because kids need something to do, it's much more popular in the Northeast. Now, how did we, let's talk about track and field has cross country in the fall, indoor track in the spring, in the winter, outdoor track in the spring/summer, and it goes off to in the professional circuit. There really isn't professional cross country in the same way that there's professional track. There's not really a league, and there's not really a set of lots of events. There is a world championship that happens every other year in cross country, a world cross country championships. But it is under-participated in. Is it really participated in Europe?
Is that why cross champs kind of races, you know, like they have during TRE here, you'll get a bunch of, it's like an invitational. You get a lot of the pros, the pro
yeah, because
groups
it's
will
the
come
tiny,
and run.
Because they're doing, they're coming
it's
off
like
their,
an exhibition.
And they're coming off their fall training. Mm-hmm. They may end up transitioning to the world champion, to the U.S. championships, because you run the U.S. championships in December usually mm-hmm. to make a qualifier for the world championships, which is in February. But mm-hmm. cross country, we're just going to leave aside as its own sort of crazy
thing. I think
that's
thing. Smart, yeah.
So it's its own crazy thing. Wonderful and fantastic. But the collegiate system has set up cross country in the fall, indoor track in the winter, and track outdoor track in this late spring and into the early summer. And out of the collegiate system in the U.S., everything else is built out, because we're going to be talking about this a lot of times around the context of the United States. Europe does things a little bit differently. They don't have, they don't bake their track and all of their distance running is not baked into the collegiate system. It's baked into a club system. So they run on a club system, which is basically you represent your local community. And these communities have a coach sometimes that'll be like the London Hertfordshire Cross Country Club or the Hertfordshire Track Club. And they train in that location. And they'll use cross country as sort of strength training for the indoor and the indoor season. And then some of them will run indoors, some will run outdoors.
Do you think that's because their universities have a different, they have a different ethos around what the university does?
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, I mean, obviously it's higher education, but like it's, do they think of it as more utility there? And therefore like sports is sometimes just a little bit,
yeah, I think there's a
it.
there's a probably a really interesting history to go through and why that happens. I do know that there have been times during in my career where there have been a resurgence of interest in club versus collegiate running. Mm-hmm. But there's another whole thing where a lot of Europeans and especially New Zealanders and Australians come to the U.S. for the competitive indoor the competitive collegiate season, because the level of competition is much higher.
And it's so organized.
So well organized.
Like,
and for that demographic of like, you know, 18 years old to 22 years old, the kind of competitive gauntlet that you go through is
coaches,
so
and
helpful.
You can kind of pick your style.
And then some stay here in the States. Some of those foreigners stay in the States. Like you got Josh Kerr who stayed in the States, Jordy Beamish who just won the world championship stay in the States. Garcia Romo stay in the States. A good number of people who have Ollie Orr from Australia, they all have stayed in the States. And then some go home to their home country and train there back at their home country.
Do the clubs start before college and they train people
clubs
up?
Clubs usually have youth element and they stay in their club all the way through.
That's cool.
Like Josh Kerr and Josh Kerr is Scottish and so is Jenna Recchi and so is another athlete, Laura Muir. These are some of the best in the world mm-hmm. in the middle distance. They all trained in the same track club in Scotland or a very similar track club. They came up together and then they went to Jenna and Laura stayed in the UK and Josh Kerr went over to the US and ran it at New Mexico and got
coached
there.
When they have meets, do they have club meets?
They do have club
invitationals, like specific. Do they have maybe specific platforms to race on?
They do have platforms to race on. I'm not really fully cognizant of that because I don't really see what they're doing until they show up at the world level, right? So yeah. I'm not over there, but I'm not that much. That's where I'm not so much of a fan that I pay close attention to what's going on at the national level in each of these other countries. Mm-hmm. I do pay close attention to what's going on the collegiate level and the national level in the United States, but my fandom is collegiate, high school and collegiate cross country track and field, and then pro
track
and
field.
And then they're kind of separate entities.
When you, is it from college to pro, that can you go, obviously it's a post collegiate career path, or
it
is
can
it,
be a post collegiate career path, but we're seeing more and more of athletes bypassing the collegiate system to go pro, especially if they're super good.
What does that
really,
look
really
like?
Good.
What does that mean in terms of
so
do they drop
means,
out of college or do they stay in college? And
they'll go on whatever path is appropriate to them.
Okay.
A lot of them, any athlete that's going from the collegiate, bypassing the collegiate system is already at a really, really high level. So this would be like...
who are they running with? Like Bowerman or...
Well, it depends. You know, not many,
NAZ or?
Almost no distance runners do this. One a year, maybe one every 2 years,
sure,
is good enough at the high school level to bypass the collegiate system. Mm-hmm. 99% of high school runners who want to continue through the collegiate system. We've had a few athletes that have bypassed it. You might remember the name Mary Kane. Mm-hmm. She bypassed it.
What happened? I know.
Let's not go.
That's
down.
A long story. That's a long because story. That's yeah. a full.
But I just wanted to yeah. give you an example. There's another athlete named Hobbs Kessler who runs for Adidas. He bypassed the collegiate system. He tried Michigan for like a season, and then he decided not to stay there. And then he decided to use another coach basically what happens in that case is I'm sure that they get a funding for their education by the shoe company. And this is another thing about track and field is, let me just finish this before you jump in. Because I want you to jump in wherever you want, but I also have to follow a few threads to the end and then finish and then jump in. But one of the key things about the sport is that it is at the pro level, it is run completely by the shoe companies.
That's what I was going to, that's what pro, I was about to say. Yeah,
that's
it
the
seems
pro
like,
level.
What designates a pro?
It's that they are typically sponsored, they're professional because a shoe company is paying them a contract.
That seems a little bit esoteric in terms of designating pro versus collegiate. Would you agree? Is that kind of a point of contingency in terms of like how that's delineated? And basically, you get to decide that you go pro when you take a paycheck. Is that correct?
Except for the new
NIL?
NIL,
yeah.
Which is changing the format. But yes, for a very long time. Forever, actually, until 2020 or whenever it is that they actually instituted this, 2019. I forget what they instituted it before COVID, and then it just came up really strong after that. But yeah, that there was you would basically compete for your college program, and they kept all the rights to your name, and they kept all the rights to your successes. Not a really big deal in track and field because the collegiate system provides a venue for the ability for fan base to get excited about an athlete and an individual and in whatever event that they're in. So it's a good proving ground to gain the name and reputation that people can pay attention to for you. But there are athletes who come up who can bypass that altogether. For example, there's a pole vaulter named Mondo Duplantis. He's from Louisiana.
Okay.
And his mom is Swedish and his dad's Cajun.
That's cool.
He competed, I think, for one semester or 1 year at LSU. I don't even know if he went for the full year at LSU. And then he went pro because he's the best pole vaulter in the world by far. And he was already one of the best top three pole vaulters in the world when he was in high school. But he decided to try the collegiate system. But then he was like, I'm missing out on all these opportunities to generate revenue at all these championships by getting bonuses. So you get paid by the shoe company. Nike pays him. Puma. He's sponsored by Puma.
Yeah.
But then he also has what they do is they give you a base salary, and then much of that, and it's usually a little lower than you see in other sports, but there's bonuses around medals and records.
Sure.
So if you get a bronze medal, silver medal, gold medal, different bonuses structures there. And then if you run certain times, there's bonus structures around that. So that's how the pro system works. The collegiate system is also time-based in the sense that you have to get, well, let's leave that alone.
Does an NIL deal, is it legal to bonus performance with an NIL deal?
I don't think so. I think it's
you see what
just
I'm saying? So like,
no, I don't think it's based on that. I'm not really, I'm not in the collegiate system now, so I don't really pay very close attention to it. So I don't know the ins and outs of it. I don't know the legal parameters, but I would be very surprised if it does have a bonus structure. It might, but I don't think it does. But
they might have some type of accord that like says,
it seems that it could create some more challenges, but it may be that that's part of what they're doing.
That would
really
make
sure.
It very opaque between a collegiate runner versus a pro runner.
If one of our listeners knows that answer, you feel free to jump in and tell us. That's how it's kind of built out. Now, let me go back to one of your original questions, because we've been jumping all over everywhere. Mm-hmm. One of the things you said was, why am I not a fan? And I'm going to tell you, this is a bit controversial. You're not, because I was starting to talk about this when I said how well participated the sport is in high school. But the reason you're not a fan is because we have a very poor governing structure. We have the United States Track and Field Association, USATF.
Yeah.
And they do a terrible job of pushing the sport they've chosen to, in my opinion, they've done a terrible job of highlighting the sport. They focused on a four-year cycle that really tries to take advantage of television. And because the sport has been so heavily focused on TV and the way TV rights work and the way the TV operates, the sport itself has lost much of its three-ring circus appeal. So
yeah,
much,
because it seems like track and field is when
the Olympics,
when it's broadcasted.
And there's a track and field event. There's something going on in the sport of distance running almost every weekend, whether it's a really big road race or if it's a big track and field meet, a cross country meet.
So you could follow it technically.
We do.
The whole time.
All year round. There's something almost every weekend. There's some critical.
I think I was a sucker for the TV zeitgeist. I grew up in the era where you had to watch TV to get what you needed.
And this is why, this sport has suffered for so long. This is why it's not as relevant, because people think of it only as a four-year event and not as a yearly narrative, not as a story. And this is why I argue for it being entertainment. We need to change it. Michael Johnson, you may know that name, one of the great sprinters in the world. He's actually getting ready to start, be part of a new track series that he's trying to create.
I saw his post that you shared that he was, maybe they're looking at kind of like
a way to narrativize this, a way to tell the story of the sport a little bit better. Because what's going on right now in the sport is absolutely revolutionary. And this is the other thing. This is what I pitched to you the other day before we left. I was like, if you're ever going to be a track fan, now's the time to be a fan. The performances are off the chart at every event. And every event has both an American storyline and a world storyline that is historically intriguing, built along tribal lines, around lines of nationality, around lines of competitive, where athletes are really going head to head with controversies and rivalries. The excitement is off the charts, and we'll get into that in this future episodes when we talk about the 8 and then the 15 and the storylines that are going around those events.
Okay,
but from a bigger picture, the reason why it's not so popular is because we've been so TV centric, and in my opinion, we fail to tell the story of the three ring circus. If we can get back to that, that'll be great. But I do think
that's such an interesting situation, and
it's especially disappointing to me because, you know, when somebody breaks the world record, it's on ESPN. On SportsCenter, and everybody watches. I mean, I've never met anybody that doesn't want to watch a race.
Mm-hmm.
It's like everyone understands it. There's a
starting
line,
but they don't know when. They don't know contextually when. They don't know why that story is particularly relevant. They don't know who. They don't know. They don't know any of the bullet points of what builds a proper backline.
Correct.
And to me,
each race has its own strategy.
Because when I think of track and field, I'm thinking, you know, when people talk about it, I hear, I'm not privy to the seasonal arc. Now I am. It's so basic to even think about it. It's like, well, obviously, that was when it was in high school. I think they were even asking, like, are you going to do indoors this? You know, I was like, what? I know it sounds so basic, but it was just such an interesting way to peel it apart, because this is kind of blowing my mind. It's blowing it, and it seems so basic, but it's blowing my mind that you see it the way that you do, where it seems so didn't seem sterile, but the stats and the figures that you hear constantly, that I hear constantly, people throw around numbers a lot. They just throw around a lot of numbers, but out of context, the numbers don't mean anything to me.
And they also throw around personalities or people. Sha'Carri Richardson.
Mm-hmm.
Sha'Carri Richardson. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, you're supposed to say Sha'Carri. Sha'Carri Richardson, you know who that is. Yes, she's all over everywhere. She's the best. She just won the world championship in the 100 meter and surprised and shocked the Jamaicans, who are usually the powerhouse in that event. Americans are always in it to win it, but Sha'Carri had a really unexpectedly great race, and She's a personality. And I love that we've got these personalities. But I think this is where USATF went off the rails. We got into a four-year cycle, which didn't tell the story of the three-ring circus. It told the story of just the Olympics and what we see at the Olympics. And the Olympics are stretched out way too long. Like, those events go on. I mean, it's a two-week long, and you're watching one event, like two events, and it's just too stretched out, in my opinion. And then we focus on either the personality, right, of the athlete that is doing it, or the times that they're running. Instead, what we should be talking about is the story or the history and the narrative of the event itself. If we could get that across to people, if we could show the arc of how the 100-meter dash has improved over the last 100 years, how the storylines in the 100 meters have gone on, especially in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and the aughts, when modern track and field came into its heyday with professionalism, then what you would see is this wonderful narrative arc that almost everybody can jive with. Look at the NBA. Look at the national, NBL, Major League Baseball. Look at NFL. Look at the NHL, National Hockey League. The way the sports in those events have changed from the amateur era into the pro era is a completely different narrative arc that we've all been able to follow as sports
fans. Why have
we
been able to follow it? You remember Mark McGwire?
Because it's all about the sport.
Because
it's all about the sport. It's about how the man hits the ball across the thing, how the man pitches the ball across the plate.
But why was it so easy to digest?
Because they're telling the story of the event. They're telling
the single event.
The single event in the way it plays. It's part of a context. It's all going in. And yes, you can get all into a person's batting average, and you can get into a person's ability to steal, but you're really...
But when we were in it, it was Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, and then when they came out with all of kind of like the drug testing and everything, that was like, you didn't even have to be a fan. You didn't have to know what an RBI was. You didn't have to know shit, but you are into it. Is the thing with track and field the fact that there's, you named probably, I don't know how many events, but like there's quite a few events, and it takes a lot of people to build a track and field team. Like,
yes.
A lot of people, and they're,
yes,
all separate. Do you think
and
they're
very different event
you're saying
types.
It's a three-ring circus, but the layperson sees it as a bunch of different things.
Correct. And that's and we don't recognize the value of each of those individual events in their own beauty. We privilege some of them. We've privileged the 100. We've privileged the mile. We've privileged the marathon.
Yeah.
The jumps, the vault, the throws, like, they get short shrift. The best throwers in the world, the second best American throwers, are having a hard time putting food on their plate. The throwers make the least amount of money in the sport. And it's so sad, because their event is just as exciting and the storyline is just as good. But because no one focuses on it, because our sport has failed them, because track and field is focused on the sprinters and the distance runners to the exclusion, in my opinion, of the other events that get short shrift. So that's why I was always, Chris and I would always talk about the other events, because we wanted to make sure that people understood that we value them as important to the sport. We are going to focus on the distances because that's our particular area of interest. That's what we grew up in. That's where we're sitting. But in order for track and field to thrive in the next era, everyone needs to care about the throws. Everybody needs to care about the jumps. Everybody needs to care about the sprints. Everybody needs to care about the distances. We cannot be in tribes. We have to see it as a three-ring circus and know that the bearded lady is just as important as the fire breather, or that the acrobats are just as important as the guys who roll around in the barrels.
Mm-hmm.
They're all a part of keeping the show in play and important to it. And track and field.
Well, historically, it seems like track and field is one of the most relevant historical entertainment systems there.
It's also the easiest to understand.
Yeah.
Like, I watch football with my daughter, and I have to tell her, that's a slant route. What do you mean a slant route? What the fuck is a slant route? Why is that? What is the offense and the defense doing? Why are these players in the back and these players in the front? You can get it after a while.
Track and field is very... Point A to point B.
Point A to point B. You just need to know the distance. Yeah. But the reason why people get bored is because nobody's telling the story of that in the historical context or in why the excitement is there. So
USATF, it being
it has
kind of
failed.
Beholden to the broadcast systems and the idea of the Olympics, which is a great idea.
And then,
but
to
it's
the,
also,
and then also to so just to the 4-year system, but also to the key player, only focusing on the storyline of the key athlete. That it's wonderful to know Sha'Carri Richardson's story, mm-hmm. but we want to know Sha'Carri Richardson's story in the context of the.
I'd rather know who she's competing against,
so
and
you
why.
Can know why she's so important yeah. and why she's so different mm-hmm. and why there's this drama. People don't like Sha'Carri because she's got the long fingernails. She's ethnic. She's black, right? She lives that up. But you and I, we've lived in the Sha'Carri ran at LSU. So you know where she comes in the South. We know these are our people. We're all part of the same group, right? Like, don't look at her as like a hood, right? Like that kind of look at her like she's a hood rat or something. It's like, stop it. This is exactly what we want in our sport. We want Sha'Carri to be Sha'Carri.
She's
we want
bringing
her own vibe, the thing we talk about all the time. What's your personal style?
So
we want Mondo Duplantis'
personal
style.
This culture we live in tends to take the ideas and amplify them at the expense of the narrative.
Correct. Yeah. And I think then we tell the story in one way, but we tell it in a way that's just so facile and so stupid and so and doesn't want to get into the mess, into the murk, into the stuff. You know,
well, that's because there's a lot of reasons for that.
There's a lot of cultural
endorsements
reasons for that.
And it's like kind of,
but the shoe companies have been privy to that. That's Nike's fault, because Nike wants to sell that athlete to sell their shoes rather than, what if we sold the 100 and then the participants that are in it? What if we sold the 200?
Oh, yeah,
what if we sold the 400?
Yeah.
That's my argument. That's what I wanted to do. I want them to sell the shot put. So 1 year, 2004, I was sitting in the stands at the Olympic trials with my very good friend, Adam Daly. He and I broke up over the last couple of years, but he and I were sitting in this. He's a local. He ran to Austin High, ran at Arkansas. His wife ran at Arkansas. Wonderful, wonderful people. They are really good friends. We were sitting in the stands at Hayward Field on the backstretch, and we were watching. And I think it was 2008, and I was coaching at UT. So I had a bit of track fan all my life, but we were coaching at UT, so I knew all the individual players at the collegiate level. And I'd been following the pro level. So I was sitting in the stands, and the people that we were sitting with were track fans, but they were track fans. The Oregon track fan is sort of a track fan because that's what you do in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And they understood the distance races pretty well, and they knew the story of the 1500.
They're seeing it through the lens of Nike.
But they'll also see it through the lens of the 1500 and the 5K and the
History in Oregon with the middle and long distance.
But they didn't know the players very well. So we were sitting there, and you go to the Olympic trials and you're there for, the way they've set it up is so stupid. They do 4 days and they take a break and then they do 4 more days. This is what USATF is doing that's so wrong with the sport. Let's do it all in the shortest amount of time we possibly can and really, really sell it. But one of the things that was going on is Adam and I were talking mm-hmm. about what was going on. Because he knew some things and I knew some things. He knew personally some of those athletes because he competed with them or against them or things like that. And then we were talking about the vault and the throw. And the people around us, every day that we would show up, because you got your seats and you sat, they were all listening to us. And I had this idea with Adam. I was like, you know what we should do? This was like before I even knew. We should create a little headphone system that people could put on when they sat in the stands. And then you and I would talk over, all right, guys, pay attention over here. What's happening over here is we've got the vault. We've got Mondo going for the world record. You've just saw him just jump at this height. He's jumping at this height and this height. And if you wanted to,
where it all started. And where it peaked. This is where, you know.
And the days before, you could even set it up to where you could sell that to them in a way that they could have a full experience, just like they read a novel. And I would do that. Anyway, we had this idea, right, that maybe we could do something like that. Never did anything. But I still think that that's the reason. That shouldn't be an idea. That should be what USATF is doing. Their announcer should be doing that all the way through. They should be setting up the meet so that one event happens right after the other event, so you can jump from one thing to the next thing, and that the athlete, the viewership, is not just focusing on one event. They're focusing on all the events that are happening at the same time to create the kind of vibe, all right?
Yeah.
These things are really important to me, and that's why I wanted to have this introductory episode where we sort of said, these are the things going on in the sport. This is how the sport operates. Now, let's talk about the seasonality here, too, okay? So indoors is valued, but it's really mostly valued in a world championship year. So what's the difference between world championships and Olympics? This is very important to understand. The Olympics, as everybody knows, is once every 4 years. But our sport can't survive on once every 4 years, right? We need, so then the sport has created a, and the sport, by the way, is governed by a governing body. All, just like the NFL is a governing body, we have our own. It's called World Athletics, okay?
Used I'm to be familiar the, with them.
Used to be IAAF. They've now changed it to World Athletics. Seb Coe, the great 1,500-meter, 800-meter runner from England who won multiple gold medals, he and had world records, he's the head of it all. So they have decided that they're going to, they've been having since 1987 world championships every in between years. So there's one gap year where there's nothing. So it usually goes, let's say an Olympic Games, then it'll have the next year after that as a world championship, then a gap year, then a world championship, then an Olympic game, then a world championship, gap year, world championship, Olympic Games. Going on concurrently for the pros is what we call the Diamond League, which is a series of races that are going on, that track meets that happen starting in the summer in major European cities. And also in, now occasionally in, we've got one maybe happening in Australia. We've got one in China. We've got one in the U.S. at the Prefontaine Classic. It's been going on for a long time.
Okay.
And, yeah, but most of them are happening in Brussels, in Zurich, in Nice, in London, in a variety of different places. And there's a league called the Diamond League, and they get points. The pros get points for every race that they win there, and then they do a final event, end of the year event, that then they make more money. That happens year in, year out, every single year, no matter
is
what.
Is the Prefontaine Classic the only one that we have in the U.S.?
Correct.
Why don't they... See, that's the weird thing to me.
Because it's like there's not enough viewers.
Somebody like me sees the Prefontaine Classic and goes, what the fuck is that?
Because there's
it's
not
a cool, it's cool. Like they're all like, I don't know what it is, but they never tell it. They never say like, this is a part of the Diamond League. Like that is some crazy shit. Like there's three layers. You well, got the Olympics,
it,
you've got.
They're saying it at every time they show it, but you're just not keying into it because you've never been told the story of our sport.
That's what I'm saying, man.
That's like what we're trying to do. I'm trying to get people to understand that there is a story to our sport. If people are interested in this, I'll do separate podcasts completely that are just on the history of it. God, I love this shit. But I just don't ever think there's going to be enough listeners to actually warrant doing it. But what you and I are going to do is basically...
But that would suggest that the sport is dying and not growing.
The sport has been has gone through so many ups and downs, so many... Just like rock and roll, man. It's just like anything. You know, rock and roll was supposedly dead. Now it's back and...
Yeah.
Doing just fine, right?
I have a feeling that track and field will, even when I say dying, I also in the same sentence can say it probably will be the longest lasting thing that we have in athletics.
Well,
just because,
yes.
Because it's such the...
Doesn't need a lot of
the
gear.
Human condition.
And
in
we've
an
been throwing,
you know?
and especially in the West,
yeah.
Which is the primary area, although I will say track and field, almost every nation has... World and Olympic champions from their nation. Small islands.
World champions being from the world champs that biannual.
Or the Olympics being... We've seen world championships in almost every country that is in the world. India is not well represented in the sport of track and field. It's not really highly valued. We're seeing a few more Indians. Nepal, those... But China has been represented... Australia, New Zealand, the islands, the Samoan Island, those islands out there, they have throwers frequently. You see all over the West, you know, all over Europe, you see athletes at every level. We've had recently the Olympic gold medalist was an Italian sprinter of African descent, Italian sprinter.
So this is this changes everything because if you get into it like I did, which was you're kind of funneled into this sport. You don't quite understand. They never even explained it back in high school.
No.
Nobody even had the cards to be able to say, this is the deck we're playing with right now.
And the only reason I know about it is because I got indoctrinated to this by my dad.
Yeah.
And so I read the magazines, then I watched the races, then I watched the Olympics every year. I'll never forget my freshman year watching the 1984 Olympic Games. And then I, you know, and then when YouTube came on back in the 2000s, now I'm a historian. I've watched nearly every world championship and Olympic championship race that has as video footage since the dawn of the sport. And I've been reading about the sport for a long time because I'm just so intrigued by history, but especially by our sport. So I have a lot of knowledge about the 20s and the 30s. I have knowledge about the 1800s when the sport of track and field was not really a sport. What it was, this is crazy. A lot of people don't know this. It was long distance track, indoor track gambling. So
in the 1800s?
Yes.
Okay.
There was late 1800s,
like
early
1900s. Horse racing, but with humans?
Yes. And they were in Madison Square Garden with giant smoking cigars. And the guys are running 60 miles, 100-mile races on a tiny little indoor track. And they're making bets as they're going along. And there's cute. They were making more money that time. I don't know if it was more money, certainly making more money if you do inflation, right? Mm-hmm. If you adjust it for inflation, they were making more money than many of the world best track stars. I mean, people were making
$30,000
then you had the question, were they really competing or were they throwing it? You know, all the things that we hear about in boxing and all those other things. Yeah, like you have all that stuff, but that was going on. Horse racing was, humans were racing indoors. And then we had gentlemen events in 1897, de Coubertin decided to restart the original Olympics that were set at the Olympics that were supposedly in our Greek antecedents.
Yeah.
Back in the 500 BC.
It was a historical reproduction.
Correct. To try to bring a value to sport, to try to heal the world's wounds through sports, which is what you hear about with the Olympics. That's the Olympic spirit that's talked about, is an attempt to bring all the different nations together and to work out some of our challenges on a competitive field. That's it. And then to honor the amateur sport part of it, that these were gentlemen. And at first, ladies were not allowed. Eventually, ladies were let in. But they were gentlemen sportsmen. So it was very much, you had to be pretty wealthy to be able to do it. Although very quickly, we had Americans that were poor. Jim Thorpe, who is was a Native American football player, but then he became world famous for being a track and field athlete because he won the decathlon and then was in the movies and everybody knew who he was, and he's an incredible story. I mean, our sport has an incredible history. It was far more popular comparatively across the world.
So
it's super
watched,
popular.
This is gonna make me sound like a complete idiot. I just watched the Boys in the Boat movie about rowing.
Mm-hmm.
And that was back in the 20s, in the Depression. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, the Olympics had been around for about
20 years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So like, you know, maybe four cycles of the mm-hmm. Olympics. So it's interesting to think how fresh of an idea, like there were four events that they didn't tell that in the movie where it was. It's so interesting. It seemed like when you watch something like that and you watch somebody rowing a boat in the Great Depression, it's like you're missing a whole different piece of the puzzle, which is like the Olympics. It's the fourth one. Like this, it was, when did it get introduced in the collegiate system? Why were they starting to put rowing? Like, was rowing in the collegiate system before the Olympic? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, there's so much there in terms of the contextual arrangement as to why the Olympics are both important, but also like how it all kind of where all the pieces started to land in the collegiate system leading up to where we have today, because that's clearly the breeding ground for the acceleration of the sport. Was
the system we have today came into its really into its own in the 60s. So that's when television started to come in, and there was more And then the collegiate system got really strong during that period.
Coincidentally, that's around when Nike put the Cortez out, and you know they were
Nike started in 72, so I think 71.
Oh yeah, it was 76 is when I think that
first
was their
started
Olympics.
Pushing, yes.
Yeah. So okay, so just a little bit after that, but it was then modern track and field is about as new as modern running.
It's pretty much the same.
Yeah.
Around the same.
Okay.
I do think, you know, you do have an incredible history before that. So the history in the 20s with the flying fins and in the distances like Paavo Nurmi. I mean, just incredible storylines. But really, I think the real stories start around 19. I would start it with maybe in the 50s, maybe with, but anyway,
That's fascinating. No, that's...
What we see today, I was going to use this as an example. It'll come up later when we talk in the 800. But there's one of the greatest Olympic sportsmen of all time, and I mean by that all sports, all things, is a gentleman who lived in Dallas, Texas. He's a New Zealander who was an exercise physiologist in Dallas, Texas. His name is Peter Schnell, and he won the 800 and the 1500 in the 1960 and 1964 Olympics. Mm-hmm. He was running times in the 800 that would be competitive today, in kangaroo leather spikes with an inflexible spike plate on incredibly soft cinder tracks. And so, you know, the thing that's why I call the modern era is we've seen that era, especially in the middle distances.
It's the way that we think about it too, like the materials that we're using to facilitate the sport.
Correct.
It would be the equivalent
technology
of
comes on board.
Why were we playing basketball on a wooden court?
Right.
What the fuck? That shit's EVA now. Imagine if the whole sport was like, you know, compressed rubber.
And in 1964 was the first year that we had an African win a medal. We had Abibi Bakila in 1964. Mm-hmm. He won the Olympic Games marathon barefoot. He ran the race barefoot and won. I think it might have been 60 or 64. Mm-hmm. So that's when really you start seeing the African movement. And then in 1968 Olympics is when the Olympics games were in Mexico City, and that's where the Kenyans really came on strong because they lived and trained at a high elevation and the races happened at high elevation. So
that's
all of a sudden
cool.
A disproportional number of medals were won by the Ethiopians and Kenyans, and people were like, oh, that's just because they were at altitude. Well, then in 1972 they came through and they were winning again, and then Africa, it became a sport that really was where you could see people of all colors. It really has been a sport. It hasn't been as represented in the Asian countries, although you do have a long history in the marathon of Japanese. But Africans and Europeans, you know, Americans and Islanders, it's a sport that really has this element of a mix of body types and a mix of races. And a mix
and
of cultures.
And eras.
And
you
eras.
Know, it's like rock and roll.
Yeah.
Went from the 60s, 70s, 80s, mm-hmm. 90s. It sounds like there's some fierce, fierce differences between each era and how that they were.
And we're going to go through a little bit of that when we go through each of the events. Because that's what I'm hopeful to do, is to go through the 800 all the way
through
an episode. And then go through the 1500 all the way in an episode. So I think that's basically the main frame. So I just wanted to make sure people understood that that's the way the format works, is that every year there's events to watch in track and field. Some years there's these world championships that are really a big deal, and there's big money and big bonuses structures in that place. And then every fourth year there's the Olympics. This year we have the Olympics again. Now remember, we're not very far removed from the Tokyo Olympics because of the pandemic. Tokyo got pushed a year, so everything kind of got messed with pandemic, but now we're back on our cycle, and this is the Paris Olympic Games. I think are going to be the greatest Olympics in the sport of track and field that we've ever seen. I just think the level of improvement we're seeing in our sport because of technology, but also because of competition, and also because I think that the internet is finally robust enough, and YouTube is finally a place where people go. That you can watch any track. So there's a kick-ass meet this weekend happening in Portland, No. In Southern California, around the LA area, called the Sound Running 10K. And it's an exhibition 10K race, because one of the things that's important to recognize that we'll be talking about is that most people think of going to the Olympics or going to the World Championships. You go to your national championships and you get top three, and then you make it to the next level. Not every country operates that way. Some countries select their athletes.
The national championships. One second.
Mm-hmm.
The national championships are they on the same years as the World Championships?
There's a national championships every single year.
But on the years that the World Championships
and
lays,
the Olympics
do they
happen,
get to escalate?
No, the Olympics and in the Olympic year and the World Championship year, the only way you make it to the Olympics and the World Championships is going through, at least in the U.S., through your national meet. We call that the Olympic trials. Or it's the nationals if it's getting ready for the World Games. But like the U.K., they don't do that. They select their team.
Let me wrap my brain around that. I need to confirm this. So every year we have a national championship.
Mm-hmm. And every year we have a Diamond League.
Every year we have a Diamond League. Oh, shit. Okay.
That's ongoing consistently. Otherwise, the sport would die. We need enough revenue. We need enough.
It's safe to say that in one event, you could probably compete in both at the highest level.
Oh, you would
Diamond League and national championships?
They're actually all part of the same system.
Okay, so
they're all placed. And then collegiately, you see a lot of collegians go from their collegiate season into the world.
So what happens if you win the national championships in your event, or top three in your event, on an off year? Is that where the buck stops?
Yeah, that would be the end of it. If that one year where there's nothing else happening.
Okay, on a year
But then they'll go into the Diamond League races and they'll use the Diamond League races to continue to do it.
Sure.
But there's no championship beyond the national championship. Every 4 years, once there's sort of a bye year where it just chills.
So, and then on the World Championship year, you get to, in the U.S., you get to escalate.
Correct.
Depending on how that particular event decides to escalate you.
Correct.
There's some fluidity there.
We have a world.
It's almost always
we have
there.
An Olympic trials or a national championships, and the top three go to the event. Now, there's a little bit of a problem with that, is that the events
the Olympic trials are not the national championships. Is that correct?
They are in the Olympic year.
Okay.
That's just the renaming it of that year. So it's the national championship. They rebrand it because it's the Olympic trials and they sell better tickets. So because they're using that every 4 year thing. There are more people that attend the Olympic trials than attend the national championships generally.
But every year, if we want Olympic trials style running for, let's just say,
that's
marathon,
a world championship.
You just go.
Yeah, well, the marathon doesn't really count because the marathon's a different thing.
I mean, yeah. Sorry about that. But like a 10K, okay. So there's so many layers, but they all seem to work in synchronicity.
There are layers, and we'll talk about them. And I think it'll be easier to understand those layers in the event itself.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to give a frame of that before we get started, to say that we in the U.S. decide what, and most people think this is happening across the world, but it's not. We in the U.S. privilege our national championships. We value competition at the closest window of possibility to the Olympic or World Championship so we can get the best team. Because you have injuries and you have people off years and not feeling great, so we want to send the best team to the Olympics or the best team to the World Championships. Other countries, the way they do that is they privilege the best athletes in their team. So let's just say we've had it before. You might have heard this. You remember the Dan and Dave scenario?
No.
So the Dan O'Brien and Dave, forgetting his name, they were the world's best decathletes. Mm-hmm. And one of them no-heighted in the pole vault, which means they didn't get the points they needed. So they didn't make it to the Olympics because they didn't win. They didn't get top three.
Were they
three.
In the American system?
They were in the American system.
Okay.
And because they didn't get top three, they didn't make it to the Olympic Games. And the Olympic Games were much less competitive because the two best in the world were there, but because our system
That's
is so hard. But in the UK, they don't worry about that. They're like, oh, we'll always select somebody. You only have three people that can get in the event, but we'll select somebody. Okay? So that's important to know. But on top of that, because the world level has gotten so competitive, and then especially in the distance, in the middle distance and the distance races, the Kenyan and Ethiopian athletes are so dominant in terms of their numbers, okay? So the top 10 Americans may not be in the top 50 Kenyans Or they might be, there'll be, let's just say there'll be, for every one American, there's at least five Kenyans or four Ethiopians who are as good.
Sure.
So then it becomes really important to those countries to be sure that they get the best people representing them. So sometimes some countries will select, like the Ethiopians select, and the Kenyans compete, and then they have a little bit of a selection. Mm-hmm. But the U.S. is hardcore. Now, because there's such a disproportional level, they need to make sure that we're not sending teams to the Olympic Games where people are going to get lapped in the middle of the race. So they have now standards that you have to run a certain standard in order to be at the Olympic Games. And those standards have gotten really, really stiff. Now, you probably heard that if you were watching the Olympic trials and the marathon, you were hearing all these stories about if this person gets in the top three, they won't be able to go to the Olympic Games. In fact, the man who finished third at the Olympics,
I remember them saying that he was a contingency for the Olympic spot, but they had to wait
because he hadn't gotten a world class time that the World Athletics Association, World Athletics decided that time was the time that they have to get.
Wait a second. So he hadn't gotten the World Athletics decided that time?
Yes.
And that time is what?
I can't remember. Well, 207 something, 208. Yeah.
So to run in the Olympics.
Yeah, American marathoners, male marathoners fucking suck.
So to run in the Olympics, you have to hit the Olympic standard.
Correct. And the world championship.
But to run in the
standard,
trials, you have to hit the American standard.
Correct. Which is lower, obviously, because you want to have participation and you want more people to be there. But it is different.
Why wouldn't they just go straight to the finish and say 207 is, and then we're gonna have a
gauntlet? It's super complicated. And it's contentious, and people have different opinions.
Sure.
About it. But we don't have to worry about that typically. The one event that we do have to worry about that with is, this is why I wanted to bring it up, is mm-hmm. because in the 10,000 at the Olympic level, we compete well at the Olympic level in the 10,000. In the marathon, we're not as good, especially on the men's side. On the women's side, we're equals. We're not equals to the Kenyans and the Ethiopians, but we're equals to the rest of the world. In the 10K, we are equals, okay? But there are so few 10,000-meter races competed. In fact, they've talked about removing the 10,000-meter from the Olympics and the World Championships because they feel like it's redundant with the 5K.
Sure.
I disagree with that, but I understand why they think that way.
Yeah.
I hope they never make that change. Looks like there was a couple of years ago. You might have heard John and I talking about it. We talked about it, I think, early, mm-hmm. one of our first episodes we were talking about.
In one ear and right out the other.
Yeah, but they have kept it. It's at least going on at least at this Olympics.
Yeah.
But the 10,000 is run like four times a year. And we're in the Diamond League. They don't run it very often because it's 30 minutes long and it's not great for putting on an event. Now, some meets have it because it's so well appreciated in their area.
How do you feel about it?
I think it's one of the great events. I went in the 10,000, so I'm biased.
You almost end on the 10K, right?
Well, you don't.
Do you end the three-ring circus, or do you smash
it? No, the 5K ends the three-ring circus, typically. Actually, the 4x4.
Ooh, we'll need to go into the arc of how the meets are set up,
too. The 4x4
ends it. There's so much here.
The 4x4 ends it, which is really exciting.
Fucking A, man.
But then that's when we talk about the collegiate system, because the collegiate system is a little different than the world system. But anyway, yeah, it's got a little bit of a difference there. This is why it's important, and that's why it's so confusing, because we haven't told the stories effectively for people to be able to get what's going on. But because of this qualification thing, we have to run this meet that's happening this weekend in LA that has this is going to be one of the
because
great
of what?
Races.
What was that statement?
Because you have to get you have to run at 27 minutes to have the Olympic standard.
And we're doing that.
Many, many people are coming from all over the world to run this perfect conditions, perfectly set up race. That's the sister race to the one that happens in Austin during TRE.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
The same guy, Jesse.
So they put on this race, mm-hmm. they get it all sanctioned that people can come in
and
here
get the time
right before the Olympics.
To be
maybe
sure they've gotten
their national,
so
they got their national spot maybe, correct. But they need to, they're like a hopeful, but they're going to come here.
Because if they don't get that time, then they get top three at the Olympic game, at their Olympic trials, they may not be able to go to the meet. So they want to make sure that they get it. So we'll have to
report on this.
I mean, our number one American distance runner on the men's side today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at the long distances, the 5K and the 10K, his name's Grant Fisher. I'll be talking about him a lot. The Americans have, over the last 15, 20 years, not been particularly strong in the long distance events. But we finally have an American cadre who are ready to compete at the highest level. This Grant Fisher has run 26:33. He's very close to the world record. He's very close to the Ethiopians and the Kenyans. And he's highly competitive and he's running really, really well right now. He could have qualified to go to the world championships in indoors. But because he got hurt last year, he did not get to run in any 10,000. So each year you have to qualify in a qualifying window. It's like a 18-month or a 16-month window that you have to get that qualifier before each major championship. His last 10,000 was outside that championship window. So he has to get a 10,000-meter time so that at the Olympic trials, he doesn't have to try to run super fast where it might be 90 degrees on the track. Run our 10,000s.
For the 10K, the trials haven't happened?
No, we run them very close to the event itself.
No shit.
The marathon trials are different because the marathon is so prohibitively challenging to recover from. So we run them very early because we haven't had our trials yet. So we have run those very early.
When are the trials?
They're like the end of July, end of June.
Oh, we're typically right on track.
Yeah, we're on track.
I hope everybody listening we're on is track. Finding the we're value
on,
in this.
We're on track for following the NCAA outdoor yes. season, which is going to be very exciting. We're on track to following
People
Diamond
either think
League.
That I am completely oblivious, or they're like, finally.
Yes.
I think plain speak.
Half of our listeners are going to be in half of those two camps, which is why this is good to do. This
but
is why
also,
it's so important.
I will argue, I'll end by saying this. I'm tired of the snobbery around surrounding the
so
bullshit of all the things. I don't want to hear your fucking numbers. Like, I need to know more about the sport before I learn what the fucking numbers are.
Correct.
And I'm getting tired. Even all the sites, man. Like even like Let's Run and all. I think even our hometown production company, Flowtrack, they've done a great job at like broadcasting. From what I understand, it's first class. It's all the best of the best. Now I watch the stuff and I'm like, yeah, this is badass. It's a broadcast company. It's the whole deal. But what I've been missing is the backstory. And I don't understand what I'm even watching.
You need a primer. This is what we're doing. We're trying to provide a primer for the middle distance and distances for the Olympic Games this year to try to turn Michael into a fan.
This is so good. I on a fan scale of 1 to 10, I went from like a 2 or a 3 to like a 5 today.
Because you're curious.
And I'm very curious. And I have a feeling that after I'm gonna watch this sound running race, and I'm going to see what's going on. I'm going to follow your guy, see if he gets it, so that I think like threading that needle following one storyline to the next to the Olympics is going to be nice. So
once we go through this, you will know who the major players are, and you will be excited to see how the races play out. And because we tell the story of the event over a historic period, this is what I hope to do. And then we talk about it in the modern era and who's competing. And then we also bring in the drug element, which is very important for our sport because track and field is underappreciated across the world because everybody thinks that we're dopers, as opposed our sport dopes, other sports don't. And that's absolutely prohibitively unfair because our sport is really trying to control doping where other sports don't fucking care about it. The NFL does not test as hard or as drastically as we do. NBA doesn't either. NHL doesn't. Major League
you
Baseball.
You don't really hear about a hockey player being like, they're dope and they're so good. They might be. Who knows?
This is the problem with our sport because it needs to be there because it's so challenging to do.
At the highest level, it's like you're standing naked in front of a group of people and they all have their clothes on. Like, it's such a linear idea. You run from point A to point B, you're throwing from point A to point B, you're jumping.
Like, unlike football where the arms race, or Major League Baseball or whatever, where the arms race to perform at the highest level allows for so cycling does this too. Cycling is trying to do this, but the arms race sort of already gone with that, right? So now we're really not sure, because in the late 90s, you know, it was very dope, all the way through the Lance era, and now we think it might be clean.
The last Tour de France, the times were great, but they were human. They were very fluctuating. Like, they were like and, they weren't and, human. And tech, they were massive, but it was just like
technology has changed so much in that sport. The ways that technology have impacted that sport. And that's another area in this dialogue that we can go through, is what are going on with that. But again, the whole point is to make Michael and our listeners to understand the 8, the 15, the steeple, the 5K, the 10K in a way And the marathon, I think it'll be valuable, but we won't do that as much because most
people... We can talk about the marathon all the time. And I like focusing on track and field because the marathon gets so
And there'll
much.
Be drama nearly every time we meet. So we can do what we did here. We can maybe even do it if you get excited about this enough. We could even turn some portion of each of our episodes like we did with the Running Rogue podcast where we discuss a bit of that at the beginning so people can get a feel for it. If there's an interest to that.
I like this. This is a huge deal to me, man. Like,
well, I'm excited about it too.
I fucking design running shoes for a living. I don't know shit about track and field. So it's like, take that as you wish. Like it's a thing. But like,
and I am an evangelist for the sport. As you know, I love our sport. I think it's the greatest sport. I think I can't not watch it if it's on. I watch every event. I find it to be the most compelling and interesting that there is, and I think that the storylines match up to football, baseball, basketball, hockey, and all the other sports, and I think they're easier to understand. And maybe if we provide a little bit of a primer on how to go through that, maybe our listeners can become fans too.
I should have said this in the beginning, but I'm going to take one for the team for everybody listening, because I know there's a bunch of people out there like me who feel like a complete idiot when people start talking about track and field, and no longer will you have to feel that way. If I can turn myself into a fan, then you can too. And that's the way I feel about it. I'm tired of acting like I know what people are talking about when I don't know what they're talking about just because they seem like a more diehard runner than me. And that's not the case. And I believe that there's people out there that don't know what's going on, but I also think that it's relevant. I wouldn't be doing this if I don't think it's relevant. So for anybody who, give me a little grace if you're a huge super fan and you think I'm full of shit, I don't really care about that. I'm taking one for the team for anybody who has never been able to breach the conversation. I want to thank Steve for helping me with this and being patient with me on that one. So that's all I got to say about that.
And any of our super fans who think that we're not doing a good job, we would love to hear from you. So if you think there's something we could do better, just to make people aware, we didn't prep this episode. I did it on purpose because I just wanted it to be a free flowing. And so it may have sounded a little disjointed, but believe me, any of the issues that we talk about here that I haven't clarified will get much better clarified through the lens of the event itself and the competitors themselves. Then we can kind of nuance this a little bit more as we're going along with each event. I think we'll try to do the 8 and the 15 together next week, and then we can decide whether that feels appropriate or if it needs to be the 8 by itself and then the 15 by itself. Yeah. But I'll do some prep work on that, and we'll let you know next time we meet about which direction we went and how it played out. In order to do it the true propers, each event probably needs its own category because it's so challenging to we'll get short shrift to either an era or some competitors. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. And just so people know, I don't think that the 800 is better than the 400 or the 400 hurdles. It's just the event that's the place where this starts, where aerobic development becomes really, really important. And that's what I do for a living. That's what I was as an athlete. I ran the 800 in high school, in junior high, in high school. I mean, it was mostly a miler and two miler. But then I ran in the collegiate ranks. I ran in the pro ranks. And this is the area. We've just decided that that's the spot we're going to start. And again, we're not saying the other events aren't incredible. They are, but we're just going to lean into the longer distance races because we have to start somewhere and it's a good place to start.
Agreed.
Cool. All right, y'all. Well, thanks. We hopefully you'll enjoy this journey. And those of you who are experts too, promise I'll throw some hot takes in there. You won't be bored. I'm such a fan. You won't be bored. I promise. All right. Godspeed, y'all.